This idea of the mad genius continued into the Victorian era. In the late 1850s, Charles Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, which, among other things, led to an effort to understand the scientific and evolutionary roots of creativity and genius. In fact, Victorian scholars wrote numerous books on the scientific origins of the so-called mad genius in books that captured mainstream attention, including Hereditary Genius, Man of Genius, and Insanity of Genius. Seemingly, they lacked original titles. The second of these, Man of Genius, published in 1891, sought to prove the interconnection between genius and insanity. The author, Cesar Lombroso, uses tenuous logic, claiming that the fact, now unquestioned, that certain great men of genius have been insane permits us to presume the existence of a lesser degree of psychosis in other men of genius. His evidence is often nonsensical. For example, he highlights that artists are often short and pale, and in what must have been a revelation to him, he adds that geniuses have a tendency to puns and plays upon words. Where did he think these disturbing traits came from? Hereditary degeneration, where under-functioning mental or physical conditions in parents are passed down to their children genetically. According to Lombroso, these inherited traits cause many children to go insane. In others, he said, they cause something perhaps even more suspicious, genius. His argument devolves into being wildly racist, sexist, and anti-Semitic. Lombroso points out that there are many Jewish geniuses. That said, given his belief that genius is a sign of degeneration, this is a 19th century version of a backhanded compliment. In an anti-Semitic rant, he writes, "It is curious to note that the Jewish elements in the population furnish 4 and even 6 times as many lunatics as the rest of the population." He also argues that women are rarely geniuses. It is an old observation that while thousands of women apply themselves to music for every 100 men, there has not been a single great woman composer. Rather than acknowledging the lack of opportunity for women, he concludes that women are temperamentally opposed to trying new things. Women have often stood in the way of progressive movements. Clearly, Lombroso was no suffragist, and his arguments continue to degenerate. He claimed that insanity and genius are impacted by both the weather and altitude. Countries, he goes on to say, need a hilly region to give rise to lots of geniuses. He writes, "All flat countries, Belgium, Holland, Egypt, are deficient in men of genius." Why does Lombroso think a hilly, warm climate is instrumental to insanity and genius? Because to him, while insanity is hereditary, it is catalyzed by diseases such as malaria and leprosy that flourish in temperate climates. These and other sensationalist views of genius were popular during the late 19th century. John Nisbet's The Insanity of Genius came out the same year as Lombroso's book. Both books said that it was the average man who is superior, while the genius was overdeveloped in only one skill, be it art or science, and thus deficient. These books were why, at the end of the 19th century, genius was viewed by both scientists and the public as an innate hereditary trait that cannot be fostered or amplified, other than by getting sick. At the same time, genius became tightly and negatively coupled with insanity and madness. Given that, how did we evolve from that view of creativity to the more worshipful view of genius that we hold today? The IQ of termites. The transformation of genius from a negative into a positive trait started in Johnson County, Indiana, on the Terman family farm in the late 1800s. The farm was large for the region, having some 640 acres in all. Thanks to the success of the farm, the Terman family could afford the best farm equipment money could buy, as well as an abundance of cows, sheep, chickens, and turkeys. The elder Terman was a collector. He collected land, animals, books, the Termans had almost 200 books in their family library, and children. He had 14. Of all his offspring, his son Louis was particularly special to him. Louis was 10 and the youngest of his sons. He stood out from the others with his shimmering red hair. He also hated sports and outdoor activities. In the evening, you could usually find him holed up, reading. Armed with a restless curiosity, Louis had few outlets in Johnson County other than books. So when a salesman came to the door one night hawking a book on phrenology, Louis was intrigued. First introduced in Europe in the late 1700s, phrenology was a science focused on the brain's structure and how it affected people's personalities. Phrenologists theorized that certain sections of the brain influence different traits, and that the size of those sections indicated the strength or weakness of that trait. Phrenologists claimed to be able to tell whether someone would be a high achiever or lazy and unproductive just by running their hands over that person's skull. While it was often used as a basis for racism, that night it was more like palm reading for the skull. Louis was mesmerized by the phrenologist's spiel. That evening, the salesman dazzled the family with stories and demonstrations, going around the room and evaluating the skulls of every single family member, predicting their futures. When he got to Louis, the salesman told the young boy that magnificent achievements lay ahead, that he was destined for success. And without even knowing it, this door-to-door salesman set in motion a series of events that would change how the world understands genius. Louis Terman gained two things that evening: self-confidence and a keen interest in personality differences. He began to wonder why some people, like himself, were destined for great things and others were not. His life seemed to bear out the phrenologist's prophecy. He bounded through school, skipping grades and impressing teachers. While most of his peers were stuck working the fields and tending the livestock, Louis took a different route. Thanks to the financial support of his parents, he was able to continue his education, attending Indiana University and enrolling in a psychology PhD program at Clark University in Massachusetts. His dissertation topic focused on evaluating the mental and physical abilities of smart and dull children. In the early 1900s, society viewed smart children with suspicion or even disdain. This was partially a result of the mad genius literature from the late 1800s. Intelligent people and geniuses were widely regarded as poorly adjusted and fraught with anxieties. Terman believed that testing and study could prove otherwise. Before long, he had become one of the early researchers in the emerging field of psychology. He landed a job at Stanford University, where his fascination with intelligence only grew. It was here that he heard about the first IQ test, designed by Alfred Binet in France, which was designed to identify students with learning and development disabilities. Terman had a different idea. What if you use the Binet test to assess for genius? Terman set out to Americanize the content of Binet's test and standardize the scores so that 100 would be the median result. Working with a team at Stanford, he named his version of the test the Stanford Binet test. Like the phrenologist from his childhood, Terman believed that genius was inherited and could, in fact, must, be measured in order to advance humanity. To nurture innate talent, you must first know who had it. In 1916, believing that everyone should be tested, Terman wrote The Measurement of Intelligence, a book that included an IQ test that readers could take at home in less than an hour. The book made Terman an academic celebrity. Yet, despite his fame, it took World War I to make IQ testing mainstream, when the U.S. Army agreed to test the IQs of all 1.7 million draftees. For the first time, intelligence testing became accepted in America. But there was a dark side to Terman's testing. Like many academics of his era, Terman was a believer in eugenics, a practice of trying to improve a population through forced sterilizations, abortions, or worse, against people society views as lesser. He wanted to prove that the intelligent were well-adjusted and society should be mostly concerned with the people who lacked smarts, not those who had it. To that end, he supported the sterilization of the, quote, feeble-minded, a desire that tragically became law in some U.S. states, like North Carolina, which led to the forced sterilization of some people based on their low IQ test results. On his quest to prove the superiority of the intelligent, Terman decided that he would track a group of children over the course of their lives. His reasoning was this. How would the lives of students with high IQs unfold? Would they be normal, successful, or would the Victorian image of the neurotic, mad genius be true? In 1921, he assembled a group of 1,521 young geniuses through testing and the nomination of their teachers. Those tested had an IQ over 135. In a somewhat awkward play on Terman's name, these students became known as termites. For the rest of their lives, to this day in fact, they received surveys every 5 to 10 years to assess their progress in life. Terman's hypothesis was that if he was able to identify and track the lives of high IQ individuals starting at a young age, he would most likely see two distinct things. First, they would be well-adjusted and free of anxiety. Second, they would enjoy tremendous success in their lives. In fact, the study found something entirely different. While Terman did find that geniuses were well-adjusted, their rates of alcoholism, suicide, and divorce fell into the normal range, they were surprisingly average as well on a different measure, their success. Yes, a few termites became prominent, but no one achieved groundbreaking success or won the Nobel Prize or became a household name. In fact, two future Nobel Prize winners were tested by Terman as children and did not reach the genius benchmark. In 1968, after Terman's death, one of his proteges sought to evaluate how the termites were doing at the halfway point of their professional careers. She compared the 100 termites who had achieved the greatest professional success in their careers against the others who had, in her perspective, seemingly stumbled, working at blue-collar jobs like carpentry and as retail clerks. Did the low achievers have a much lower IQ? In fact, the difference in IQ between the two groups was immaterial. Where they differed was in those characteristics attributed to nurture. The successful group had more confidence, persistence, and early parental encouragement. Terman's assumptions about intelligence were completely off base. A high IQ did not lead to greater success. That being said, his successful evangelism on behalf of the IQ test did demonstrate one thing. People with high IQs were normal and well-adjusted. Terman succeeded in helping change the perception of genius to being a positive attribute. This is a quick version of the path that has led to today's version of the inspiration theory of creativity. The idea that creativity results from a mysterious internal process punctuated by random flashes of inspiration. Today, we may still see geniuses often as neurotic, think Steve Jobs or Elon Musk, but they are no longer seen as dangerous or deserving of castigation. Today, genius is seen as something to be celebrated. But if Terman's study showed that IQ and creativity are not tied together, where does creative talent come from? Chapter 4. What is talent? Name as many uncommon uses for a hairdryer as you can. I'll give you 30 seconds. Did you come up with half a dozen? More than that? Maybe you thought of blowing dust off surfaces, or maybe you had a grandparent who taught you that a hairdryer could make cake frosting look glossy. This type of question is what researchers call a divergent thinking test. According to academics, divergent thinking, where the goal is to come up with numerous solutions to problems, is correlated with creativity. The more divergent your thinking, the more creative you are. By looking at the number and originality of your responses, they believe they can accurately assess a person's creative potential. Researchers in Austria want to further understand the relationship between intelligence and creativity. Did you need a high IQ in order to have creative talent? If so, how high? To investigate, they recruited 297 people to participate in a study. Some were recruited from a university's student population, while others were recruited from the surrounding community. First, the researchers assessed the IQ of each participant. Then, they had them answer 6 divergent thinking questions to measure their creative potential. Finally, they had a trained panel evaluate the originality of each answer on a scale of 1, not original, to 4, very original. What did the results say? There are multiple ways to measure creative potential. One is to look at how many ideas people came up with. What the researchers found was that IQ and the quantity of ideas that people came up with were strongly correlated, but only up to an IQ of 86, below the average of an IQ of 100. Beyond an IQ of 86, that relationship broke down, meaning that someone with an IQ of 90, below average, could have just as many ideas as someone with an IQ of 150, a certified genius. This is what scientists call the threshold theory, the idea that above a certain IQ threshold, every person on Earth has the same creative potential. An IQ threshold of 86 means that roughly the top 80% of the population, in terms of IQ score, has the same creative potential. That is a substantial group. But what if creativity isn't just the number of ideas that one comes up with? The researchers also looked at a more rigorous definition of creative potential, the quality of the ideas that individuals came up with. When they looked at quality, they again found an IQ correlation, yet again, only up to a point. This time, the correlation stopped at those people with an IQ of 104. This means that anyone with an IQ over 104 has the same potential to come up with original ideas as someone who falls in the genius IQ range. That too is a large group, 40% of the population. If you're reading a nonfiction book, like the one you're listening to right now, chances are you fall into that group. Worldwide, that is roughly 3 billion people. Again, that's a huge number of people who share the same creative potential as the genius elite many people idolize. How can you release that latent potential? 13 years of paint. Do you have to be born with precocious talent to be a great artist? Or can you become one through practice and hard work? More generally, is artistic talent innate? This is a key question in the study of creativity. One seemingly normal man, Jonathan Hardesty, decided to find out. Hardesty reminds me of the chatty uncle who speaks to everyone at my family reunion. He is bubbly and talkative, with a bronze-colored beard and matching glasses that I suspect are relics of a bygone decade. A familiar face you'd see at a restaurant or say hello to in a bookstore. What he doesn't look like is a classical painter. However, Hardesty's works can fetch 5 figures. He is not only one of today's most talented fine artists, but also a prolific instructor who teaches virtually all over the world. His studio, which I saw through the lens of a webcam we use for a video call, is what can best be described as a large shed in his yard. Paintings hang from the walls and lean on every piece of furniture. Hardesty uses this space not only to paint, but to teach through online courses. Hardesty didn't always want to be a painter. Other than going through a brief artistic phase at the age of 8, he did not pick up a pencil or brush to draw seriously until after college. In 2002, having recently graduated and gotten married, Hardesty was working as an assistant at the fundraising office for a university medical center, filing papers, helping with donor research, and doing grunt work. To hear him describe it, it was a cliche of a bureaucratic office environment. I'd walk in and look around, and people would be scrambling to get the last sun-dried tomato bagel from the conference room. His boss was dismissive and disinterested in him. Hardesty spent countless days filing and organizing papers, only to have to file yet more papers the next day. Eventually, to keep himself sane, he decided to pour himself into his work. If he had to be an assistant, he could at least strive to be the best possible one. To that end, he tried to figure out if the university he worked for could improve its office procedures. By digitizing its filing process, it could potentially have a huge time savings opportunity. By taking that on, he could make his life easier and save the university some money. But his boss immediately shut him down. The fundraising office was not looking for digital transformation. Looking around the office, Hardesty realized that all his coworkers were miserable. Everyone seemed to loathe their work. At that point, he realized he had to make a change. "I felt like my soul was dying," Hardesty told me. He decided to be intentional about his life. He would research the perfect job. What would make him truly happy? He ignored his filing duties and spent the rest of the day scribbling down ideas in a notepad. Hardesty knew he had to dedicate himself to the next job. His bad habit of bouncing between interests was wearing on him. One month he wanted to be a geologist and empty the library of all its geology books. The next month, he dropped geology and was committed to getting a pilot license. For a while, he dreamed of being a musician. Envisioning himself a future rock star, he joined a local Pearl Jam wannabe band. His grunge rock band developed a small measure of fame, but the life of a touring musician was a recipe for boredom. He says, "I didn't like it. It was very monotonous. It was 3 or 4 nights a week of the same exact thing." He brainstormed different career options. What jobs would allow him to be at home, near his wife, and someday his children? And could he avoid an office environment? He wanted a creative work culture, not one that reminded him of a random DMV. Hardesty hashed through various options and found a career that fit the bill, a painter. Artists practiced their trade from their homes or their studios, then shipped their work to galleries where it was sold. As a fine artist, he would be near his wife and future children, far away from pale gray office ceiling tiles. It was perfect. The only problem was that the last time he had tried painting was back when he was 8. Nor had he grown up in a family where art was emphasized or valued. Nevertheless, that night he made a pact with himself. He would draw or paint every day until he became a great painter. Hardesty's first drawing was a self-portrait. He was proud when the work was completed, but also horrified. The character looked more like the fictional oddball Napoleon Dynamite than it did Hardesty. Yet, while the self-portrait was mediocre, he had fun creating it. To get honest feedback, he started a thread on conceptart.org, a message board for artists. The post was titled, "Journey of an Absolute Rookie, Paintings and Sketches." And in it he wrote, "I'm starting from rock bottom, and I'm going to paint at least one painting and do at least one sketch every day, probably 2 on the weekends. The order you see them is in the order that I'm painting and or sketching them every day, starting on September 15th, 2002. I am bearing my soul to everyone. I will post everything I do, whether it is awful or not." Hardesty hoped he would gather helpful feedback. For those interested in creativity, however, his postings are also an extraordinary record of one person's attempt to learn a new skill. For the next 13 years, he posted continuously on his thread, updating his followers with his progress and uploading his latest paintings. Hardesty had improved tremendously over the years, but how? Lots of people paint as a hobby, even for decades, but few reach his level of skill and accomplishment. So how had he gotten so good? Becoming an expert. How do you learn to master a new skill? Most people would say practice, practice, practice. You may even have heard of the, as we'll discuss, faulty notion of the 10,000-hour rule. However, neither of these ideas gives us a satisfactory answer. Many people practice a skill for a long time, but come nowhere near the level of world-class expertise. Think about driving. Most of us have spent thousands of hours behind the wheel, yet few, if any of us, are professional NASCAR drivers. In fact, studies show that years of experience often bear little relationship with skill. One study, looked at experienced stock pickers and found that on average, they were no better at investing than novices. Another study found that experienced therapists do not have better patient outcomes than new therapists. It turns out that it is not simply years one spends on doing, that is, experience, that is tied to success. There's something else at work. Researchers who study expertise decided to look at the problem in a different way. What if you compared high performers to lower performers in a specific skill? What differences might you find in how the two groups trained and learned? One researcher compared elite sprinters to merely decent sprinters. They found that there was not only a physical difference between the two, but also a mental one. Elite sprinters focus on, quote, monitoring their internal states more closely and focus more on planning their race performance during competition than less accomplished runners. Another study evaluated elite chess players and reached a similar conclusion. Expert players had more advanced mental patterns of critical chess positions, allowing them to play better than average players. These patterns are what psychologists call mental models, your brain's representations of concepts or situations. For example, your concept of what a negotiation is like, two sides going back and forth, trying to find a solution, would be a mental model. Researchers found the importance of mental models across all types of skills. Additional studies have found similar patterns of enhanced mental models in medical professionals, computer programmers, and video game players. So, how do you learn these mental models if it is not simple experience? This is where many people fall back on a comfortable answer, talent. They'll tell you some people are born with certain skills. It is nature, not nurture. Rather than try, they kick back and decide to watch America's Got Talent, believing that the 8-year-old who can breathe fire simply was born with it. To explore the talent question, researchers decided to see if they could train normal people to accomplish superhuman things. For example, listen to this string of digits. Memorize as many as you can, and if you need to, rewind and try again. 3, 8, 9, 5, 8, 5, 0, 2, 5, 8. When you think you've memorized as many as you can, try to recall the digits you memorized. The sequence I read has 10 digits. How many did you remember? 4, 10, none? I usually get about 6. Researchers found that the typical college student usually remembers 7, making me feel bad for my lowly 6. So if you have more than that, give yourself a pat on the back. Here's where researchers found something surprising, even seemingly impossible. If they trained average college students using well-known memorization techniques, the students were ultimately able to surpass 80 digits. This study has been repeated multiple times. One researcher summarized the study of these memorization skills by saying, "Recent reviews have not found any scientifically verified evidence that would limit motivated healthy adults with appropriate instruction and training from requiring exceptional levels of performance for specific types of memory tasks." It wasn't hereditary talent that dramatically improved the memory skills of the students. It also wasn't 10,000 hours of practice, an often repeated but incorrect number that we'll discuss later. No, it was the way in which they were trained. One study that looked at highly skilled artists found that roughly half were child prodigies, while the other half had, quote, undistinguished childhoods, and were not recognized as exceptional until early adulthood. Perhaps we don't have to be geniuses to excel in creative fields. We just have to train like them. South Dakota, an artist's paradise. Jonathan Hardesty's path to becoming a master painter took him to an unconventional place, South Dakota. Hardesty was getting lots of online encouragement. Someone with the username Gigitsu, who possessed excellent grammar, said, "I feel he won't stop practicing until he owns us all. I wish I had that energy." For his part, Hardesty was drawing or painting every day. And though he initially made quick strides, Hardesty's progress stalled. Self-doubt started to seep into his forum posts. In May of 2003, he posted online, "I am so frustrated at my lack of ability. I feel like quitting. Don't worry, I won't, but I definitely feel like it tonight. I can't visualize anything in 3D. I can't control a pencil or a pen, blah. I'm going to bed." He needed a new way to learn, but how? Online, he stumbled across a training movement called the Atelier Movement. This training has origins from the pre-Renaissance era when artists were viewed as craftsmen and learned their art in workshops. In that time, master painters took on a handful of apprentices in their studio who were trained to perfectly replicate the master's work. This model became less dominant during the Italian Renaissance as wealthy patrons began funding individual artists in elite academies. However, in the 1800s, a French artist named Jean-Léon Jérôme brought back the workshop, or atelier in French, model and started training students in the studio. He taught numerous painters, many of whom went on to have successful careers. The modern version of atelier involves 4 years of full-time study. Throughout, students spend hours each day recreating hyper-realistic sketches of sculptures, a set of classic drawings called bar drawings, and live models. Eventually, they add in black and white paint. Only in their final year do they start practicing the essentials of color. After 4 years, students will have spent thousands of hours slowly perfecting the fundamentals of painting. The more Hardesty read about this model, the more interested he became. He was convinced this program would teach him the essentials of great painting. He buzzed around the web, reading all he could on the various ateliers in the United States. Finally, he found one that seemed ideal. It had a respected teacher and an open spot. There was one problem. It was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He asked his wife if she'd be willing to move there. She said yes, but her family was skeptical. They were worried that their son-in-law was going on a wild goose chase. They weren't the only ones either. A contingent of posters on his thread thought it was a scam and warned him to stay away. Nonetheless, Hardesty packed up his life, and he and his wife drove to South Dakota. His initial excitement soon faded in the face of the harsh realities of life as an unpaid artist in South Dakota. He got a job at Breadsmith, a local bakery, where he worked for 8 hours every morning starting at 5 a.m. After work each day, he went to the atelier, painted until 9 p.m., slept, and repeated it all the next day. They weren't just short on time, they were also short on money. Sometimes when bills came in, Hardesty and his wife would face a cash crunch. Hardesty remembers one time when they only had a few dollars left. They were at a local grocery store shopping for the cheapest food possible. Sick of cheap carbs, they were in search of something with protein. Scurrying around the supermarket, they stumbled upon a bag of lentils. Full of protein, it was also inexpensive. 39 cents a bag, the perfect food for a struggling couple. For the next 3 weeks, they survived on lentils and bread until they saved some money. Hardesty, having consumed a lifetime's worth of lentils, won't touch them to this day. Nevertheless, this scrappy time in South Dakota was what crystallized his transformation. What was it about this training regimen that changed Hardesty? Being purposeful. You might have heard of the 10,000-hour rule. Malcolm Gladwell coined it in his 2008 best-selling book, Outliers. Since the book's publication, the idea that with 10,000 hours of practice, anyone can become an expert has become a mantra in business and self-improvement circles. According to Google, now over 140,000 websites reference the phrase. The rule comes from research by K. Anders Ericsson, a Swedish-born professor at Florida State University who is a grandfather of the research on developing skill. However, according to Ericsson, there is a problem. The rule is not strictly accurate, or, as he put it to me, Gladwell misread our paper. There are two main flaws with the 10,000-hour rule. First, it neglects to mention that's not simply how many hours you spend that's important, but how you spend those hours. As I mentioned earlier, highly experienced therapists and stock pickers don't necessarily get better results than novices. The reason why is that most people, once they achieve an adequate degree of skill, stop trying to consciously improve. Think about driving. On your commute, you're not trying to get better at turning or accelerating. You are comfortable with your current level of skill. When you first started driving, you were, I hope, aware of every aspect of handling a car. How to turn properly, how to slow down and not rear-end the vehicle in front of you, how to parallel park, a maneuver I still avoid. As you worked on these skills, you slowly got better and better, probably without realizing it. However, over time, these skills became ingrained and subconscious. Driving became an automatic activity. The result is that as you continued driving for thousands of hours, you did not go on to learn more advanced skills. If you believe the 10,000-hour rule, every person with a driver's license should eventually develop the skills of a race car driver. My guess is, however, that although you've probably spent 10,000 hours driving, you are still a typical driver. Erickson explained why. Automaticity is the enemy of growing your expertise, he said. If you end up automating things, then you lose the ability to actually control what you're doing. If you can't control it, you can't improve it. Instead of simply practicing a task over and over again for 10,000 hours, Erickson's research shows you have to engage extensively in purposeful practice. This is a particular type of practice where you work on one small skill repeatedly with a clear goal and a feedback mechanism. Think about practicing your parallel parking with a driving instructor. Usually, the feedback comes from a teacher or experienced mentor. As you master the small skills, you advance to more difficult ones. Erickson carried out a study where he examined expert violinists to demonstrate the power of purposeful practice. What he found was that all the violinists spent roughly the same amount of time practicing per week, but the best violinists spend more of those hours engaged in purposeful practice. 10,000 hours alone did not lead to better performance. Erickson gave me an example of how the violin students would engage in this more effective practice. A teacher would listen to a student's performance and pick out flaws. Maybe they were playing too quickly. Maybe they were too slow. The teacher would then assign exercises that specifically focus on playing tempos correctly. The student would practice these exercises over and over again, and only once the teacher agreed that they had mastered them would they move on to more difficult skills. This approach doesn't just work for music. Research found similar results among chess players. The number of hours of purposeful practice was, quote, the best predictor of chess skill, not the number of games played. Non-purposeful practice, which is practicing things you already know how to do, just reinforces mental processes that are already established. Purposeful practice allows the student to gain new mental methods and thereby improve their abilities. The second serious flaw with the 10,000-hour rule is that Erickson's study did not find that 10,000 hours of even purposeful practice would make you an expert. Instead, it found that 10,000 hours of purposeful practice was the average of the experts he studied. Some achieved it with significantly fewer hours. Others achieved it with more. As Erickson explained to me, this idea that the body or the cells in your body would keep track of how many hours of practice you engaged in, and that there's some sort of magical clock at 10,000 hours that changes things, is a curious belief. Instead, Erickson believes that the number of hours someone needs to master a task is different for different people and for different tasks. For example, to master skills that have fewer people pursuing them, becoming an expert should require less time. Remember the digit memorization study? Unlike the violin or chess, there are far fewer people trying to become world-class digit memorizers. So, when researchers trained people, Erickson told me they were able to basically become the best in the world in about 400 hours. That is only 4% of the 10,000-hour rule. When Erickson first studied digit memorization, you could have become the world champion, memorizing more than 80 digits, in a year's worth of weekend practice. Things change, and today the current record for digit span requires that you memorize over 450 digits, a feat that would take considerably longer to achieve. On the other hand, in some popular fields, it can take much more than 10,000 hours. Erickson explained to me that when you look at people who win international piano competitions, they typically spend about 25,000 hours before attaining that level of performance. In short, mastering a skill takes many, many hours of purposeful practice, and the specific number of hours varies. Unfortunately, the phenomenon of mastering a skill is hard to study since most experts do not bother to keep records of their practice regimen. Without knowing it, Jonathan Hardesty had stumbled into becoming one of the few documented, public examples of someone engaging in extensive, purposeful practice. In an atelier, students spend roughly 6,000 hours of purposeful practice over a four-year period. Overall, Hardesty estimates that between his formal and informal training, he has put in well over 25,000 hours of purposeful practice. Consequently, he has gone from drawing self-portraits that look like Napoleon Dynamite to creating paintings that would make any art student drip with envy. Hardesty continues this form of purposeful practice to this day. Even though he is now a master painter, he is still trying to improve. He explained, "I still have lots of flaws in my work. I'm working just as hard as when I was first learning." He is currently working on brush efficiency, where a painter works to create an effect with as few strokes as possible by carefully controlling the pressure of the brush on the canvas. To improve on this aspect of his work, Hardesty developed a method of purposeful practice. He explained, "At the end of each session, when I have leftover paint, I'll do a stroke on a scrap piece of canvas. Then I'll try and duplicate that stroke exactly. I'll try to duplicate the randomness of that stroke. That requires the right amount of paint, the right pressure application. It's like a doctor with surgery." Today, Hardesty has launched his own online atelier called Classical Art Online to offer this method of teaching to people who can't afford to move to South Dakota for 4 years or don't want to. He is also applying his love of learning to a new skill. Hardesty now spends his free time in a different kind of studio, a jiu-jitsu gym. In fact, Hardesty has become a lover of the learning process. Quote, "It's really fun to be on the bottom of the totem pole again in something." His new goal? To compete in an MMA fight before his knees give out. Once again, he has some doubters. As Hardesty tells me with a smile, "My wife still laughs. Now she's like, 'You're not fighting.' And I'm like, 'Okay, love.'" As we wrap up our interview, he mentioned that he's soon going to compete in his first intramural fight. I have no doubt he'll be in an MMA ring soon enough. Made of plastic. The question remains, why does purposeful practice work? To answer this, I went to a surprising source, taxi drivers. Saul was a London cabbie. He drove one of those famous black taxis with hunchback roofs. This was pre-Uber. He spent his days driving the streets of London, taking customers to their desired destinations. Some destinations were requested over and over, such as the airport, while others were places he'd never been before, such as an obscure neighborhood where a customer's mother lived. As a result, Saul, like most London cab drivers, developed a keen ability to navigate. One day, Saul saw a newspaper advertisement inviting taxi drivers to participate in a neurological research study. He called the phone number. Soon, Saul was in the offices of researchers at University College London. They were planning to scan the brains of taxi drivers to see whether years of driving a cab might cause measurable changes in a driver's brain. Along with 18 other London taxi drivers, Saul agreed to participate in the study and was put through a battery of tests. He answered questions about his beliefs, values, and personal history. An MRI machine allows the researchers to observe the structure of someone's brain. When the researchers conducted MRI scans of the taxi driver's brains, they found something unexpected. The rear hippocampus of their brains tended to be enlarged. This is the area of the brain that is critical for understanding where we are spatially and how to navigate. It is activated, for example, when we use landmarks such as a large tree or a memorial to figure out how to get home. In short, the taxi driver's brains were structured to make it easier for them to get around London. That leads to the obvious question. Was Saul's brain naturally organized that way, thereby influencing his decision to join the taxi driver profession? Or did being a taxi driver somehow alter Saul's brain structure? To answer this, the researchers compared the brains of taxi drivers to those of another group of professionals who spent their days driving around London, bus drivers. What they found, when controlling for other variables, was that bus drivers did not show the same increase in the size of the hippocampus. Why? Because bus drivers follow the same route day after day, whereas taxi drivers are regularly tasked with making their way to different and sometimes unfamiliar destinations. To put it simply, taxi drivers engage in a form of purposeful practice related to navigation. Customers give them instructions. They have to figure out how to get to this and that destination. This was before GPS. And then they receive either positive or negative feedback depending on how well or poorly they did. Over time, it seems, this purposeful practice actually changes the structure of taxi drivers' brains. A second piece of evidence supported the same conclusion. Tests on taxi drivers with different numbers of years on the job revealed that the rear hippocampus increased depending on how many years a cabbie had been driving. The more experience a cabbie had navigating the streets of London, the larger their hippocampus. Similar correlations have been found with other skills. Studies have shown that musicians, bilingual speakers, and even jugglers experience changes in their brain structure over time as they practice and learn more. This concept, that our brain's physiology adapts to situations and experiences, is known as brain plasticity. In fact, even short training experiences have been shown to affect brain structure. One study found that training sessions as simple as a short vocabulary lesson affect it. Another study found that 10 60-minute computer training sessions for elderly people had a measurable effect on brain performance that persisted 10 years later. How, though? To find out, I spoke to Joyce Schaefer, a scientist at the University of Washington and an expert in brain plasticity. She believes that an underlying mechanism is neurogenesis, the continuous generation of new brain cells. According to one study, both men and women create over 1,400 new brain cells every day. Once new brain cells are created, they take 8 weeks to mature. During that time, they migrate to the most active parts of your brain. If you're a cabbie constantly navigating London, these new brain cells join forces with the part of your brain that controls your navigation skills. As a result, your brain starts to adapt to the skills you are learning. As Schaefer describes it, you can influence the career choice of that brain cell. Furthermore, if you don't challenge these cells with new experiences, they risk dying off. Put another way, learning causes our brains to retain new brain cells. These new cells connect with the specific parts of your brain that are being activated. According to Schaefer, we totally underestimate how much we can modify our brains for improved chemistry, architecture, and performance. When researchers control for other variables, they often find that people who are experts in a particular field did not demonstrate any special abilities early on in their lives. Instead, one of two things happened. First, a child may have learned a skill from another activity. For example, if you taught your 5-year-old son how to play softball, by the time he's 7, he will have more experience running, and a parent may easily mistake that as a natural talent for running track. Second, it is natural for most parents to tell a child that they are particularly good at something, even if the child is merely average. This leads to a positive feedback loop in which the child invests more time in practicing that skill, thereby garnering ever-increasing amounts of positive feedback. Over many years, that can compound into exceptional ability. Another study demonstrated that when you dig into their backgrounds, quote, elite athletes and other expert performers had different developmental histories compared to their peers. The elite performers started early with supervised training and gained access to some of the best teachers and training environments. In short, research shows that exceptional talent is not always the result of winning the genetic lottery, but instead the outcome of immense amounts of structured, purposeful practice. While the notion of giftedness stems from Lewis Terman's popularization of IQ tests, research since then reveals that people of all backgrounds have more creative potential than they realize, and that IQ is not correlated with creative potential for people of average or higher intelligence. If science shows us that creative genius is a learned skill and purposeful practice allows us to radically enhance our skills, can we engage in purposeful practice to become more creative? The answer is yes. But to understand how, it is important to understand first how society decides that something is creative or that someone is a genius. Chapter 5. What is a genius? Charles Darwin was panicked. The now elderly, wealthy naturalist reread the letter he'd gotten from a younger scientist, Alfred Wallace. A man he knew came from a humble background with only 6 years of formal education in a one-room schoolhouse in Hertfordshire, a largely agricultural city in southern England. Darwin himself began his scientific career at age 22 as a gentleman naturalist. His father was a doctor, and one of his grandfathers had written Zoonomia, an early book in the field of biology. His family was well-off and educated. Darwin subsequently earned a university degree, benefiting from exposure to more progressive intellectuals, many of whom questioned the rigid scientific norms of the 19th century. But, as we shall see, Wallace held the upper hand in this moment. After college, one of Darwin's professors recommended young Charles for a position as an onboard naturalist for the HMS Beagle as a voyage to South America. Hungry for adventure, Darwin applied and got the job. For the next 5 years, he traveled the world on the Beagle. He spent much of that time trying to maintain a detailed diary. His periods on the ocean were punctuated by weeks or months on land exploring the beautiful South American wilds. During the voyage, Darwin found himself visiting the Galapagos Islands. Seeing the differences among mockingbirds, he realized that the birds differed based on the particular island they inhabited. Legend has it that Darwin had an epiphany in thinking about the birds, and the theory of natural selection came to him in a light bulb moment. At least, that was a story I was taught in my 8th grade science class, along with many generations of middle school students. In truth, however, Darwin simply noticed that there were mockingbirds with different features. His response was mere surprise. There was no light bulb moment as to why the differences existed. No dramatic revelations occurred. His development of the natural selection concept wouldn't take place for several more years. Returning to England, Darwin labored to turn his ship diary into a book, The Voyage of the Beagle. It was published in 1839 and made Darwin a celebrity scientist, a 19th century Neil deGrasse Tyson. The book sparked a frenzy of interest around the specimens Darwin collected. He regaled audiences with the stories of his adventures, and his celebrity continued to increase. It wasn't until 1842 that Darwin began to put together his theory of natural selection. He had been reflecting on his specimens for years, and had finally come to his revolutionary conclusion. There was only one problem. By that point, Darwin was a highly regarded member of the scientific establishment. He was a member of both the Athenaeum Club, a coveted private association, and the Royal Society, the elite scientific association of his era. Despite his own rebellious nature, he nonetheless enjoyed the fame and fortune that accompanied his scientific standing. And he knew that if he publicized his latest theory, he would be labeled a heretic, or worse, ostracized from society. At that time, science was subservient to God. Evolution would mean that God hadn't made Earth's creatures in a sudden flash. Darwin kept quiet about his theory, though over the years, he discreetly told a few friends about it. In the 1850s, his friends encouraged Darwin to publicize his theory. In response, Darwin started to write his book. In poor health and in self-imposed exile at his country house, Darwin spent his time and sparse energy writing. On June 18, 1858, the 9-page letter from Alfred Wallace showed up in the mail. Wallace's first career was as a surveyor, where he learned how to note and record details. Finding himself unemployed in 1848, he made the decision to travel to Brazil as an unpaid naturalist. Upon his return, Wallace published his findings and gained a small following in scientific circles. This minor fame allowed Wallace to obtain funding for a larger, bigger expedition, 8 years traveling through the islands of the Philippines and Indonesia. On this trip, he concluded that the population explosions of certain species could eventually lead to overcrowding and the survival of the fittest, the foundation of natural selection. The concept excited him, but he knew he needed feedback from other scientists too. Wallace knew Darwin professionally. Over the years, they had corresponded, and Wallace had gone so far as to send Darwin a few of his specimens. He decided to put his ideas on the origin of species to Darwin in a letter. As Darwin was far better known, Wallace felt that Darwin might offer valuable perspective. When the letter showed up in Darwin's mailbox, the older scientist had already written 250,000 words of his book on natural selection. The book still wasn't complete. He wanted it to be so evidence-rich that no one could deny its argument. But when Darwin opened Wallace's letter, he knew immediately that his great discovery was in peril. Concerned about his reputation, but not wishing to violate the gentlemanly norms of the Victorian era, he sent his work and Wallace's letter to his prominent scientist friends, asking what he should do. They came up with a, quote, compromise. They would present a paper on natural selection that combined both Darwin's and Wallace's ideas at the Linnaean Society, a prominent scientific association. There was one problem. Wallace never agreed to this compromise. He was somewhere out in the Pacific Ocean and couldn't be reached. Darwin and Wallace had experienced what academics term simultaneous invention, a state of affairs where two or more individuals independently come to the very same discovery or conclusion. History is peppered with examples of simultaneous invention. Joseph Swan and Thomas Edison both received American patents for the incandescent light bulb in 1880. And Elisha Gray and Alexander Graham Bell both patented the telephone on the same exact day, March 7th, 1876. In the case of natural selection, the story is even more complicated. Not only did Wallace discover it at the same time Darwin did, but ancient Greek philosophers described something similar thousands of years earlier. Born in 99 BC, Lucretius, a poet and philosopher who, legend has it, died from the side effects of a supposed love potion, wrote a collection of poems in which he describes the survival of the fittest, a critical element of natural selection. And, in the ages after monsters died, perforce there perished many a stock unable, by propagation to forge a progeny, for whatsoever creatures thou beholdest, breathing the breath of life, the same have been, even from their earliest age preserved alive, by cunning or by valor or at least by speed of foot or wing, and many a sock remaineth yet because of use to man. All this is to say that nearly 2,000 years before Darwin and Wallace, the Greeks had come up with a rudimentary theory of natural selection, as Darwin even acknowledges in the introduction to his book. But it is very far from true that the principle is a modern discovery. I could give several references to works of high antiquity in which the full importance of the principle is